gently, gently, gently. Let me remind you that we invite children of all ages to remain with us during worship, but if your family or children need or desire a separate time and space, you can retire to our family room and return to worship with us shortly. I'd ask you to pray with me, please. God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be a delight in your sight. God, you who are our rock, our strength, our Redeemer. Amen. Our human bodies are amazing and fascinating, sometimes troublesome. I may only be speaking about my own. But other than our appearance or when we are experiencing pain, distress, or disease, I think we tend to take our amazing bodies for granted. And one of the more fascinating to me, developing fields of study about our bodies in recent years is this study of what's called the human biome. The human biome, B-I-O-M-E, specifically the microbiome of the human body, which is the term that refers to essentially all of the organisms that live in or on us. So just like take a deep breath. We'll only spend a few minutes on this, so put your ew factor to the side for a moment. Our human microbiome, all of the organisms that live on us and in us, how our body is really not just a single entity as we like to think about it, but our body is its own ecosystem. From our eyelashes to our intestines, we teem with other life forms. Most of them are benign, or they simply live on us or in us. And while we are well aware that some of them can make us ill, we are increasingly aware that many of them are important to keeping us well and actually fending off infection and ill health. Some of them do both. For example, the bacteria that causes stomach ulcers actually seems to protect the esophagus against cancer. So, too much, a lack thereof. In other words, what is not good for our stomachs is good for our throats. So some work both ways. And there is even increasing evidence that the widespread use of antibiotics, which kill both harmful and helpful microorganisms and bacteria, actually increase asthma, inflammatory bowel disease, and even obesity. This ecosystem, our human biome, has evolved over many, many millennia as this complex and interrelated system, and our bodies actually teem with so much life that our bodies, as we see them, are comprised of more microbes than human cells. Okay. It is estimated that there are 10 times, not just a few, 10 times as many bacterial cells in our bodies than our human cells. So number for number, there are more cells of other life forms in your body than your own cells. That is pretty amazing. So that classic saying, no one is an island, that's really right. We are not an island. We are an entire ecosystem. And when we hear and remember that image of, quote, the web of life, we actually don't have to go beyond our very own bodies. It gets really, really personal all of a sudden. The web of life, which is our own bodily ecosystem. I find that, after we get over the ew factor, fascinating. Fascinating. Happy Earth Day, MCC Portland. It may seem odd that we started there, but I'll get back to that. Earth Day, first celebrated in 1970, now it is a worldwide 193 nations now observe Earth Day on April 22nd, today. And events around the world help raise awareness and demonstrate support for environmental protection. And thankfully, increasingly, that happens in religious communities and communities of faith. And it is perhaps even more important now than it may have been 40 years ago, because we are now in a time of undeniable, contrary to what other strident voices say otherwise, undeniable scientific evidence of climate change. And even our hard-fought-for environmental protections are under threat of being rolled back. Earth Day is more urgent now than ever. So our human biome may seem a strange place to have begun talking about Earth Day by reflecting on our bodily ecosystem. But not only does it make the interdependence of life really personal, because it is our skin, our flesh, our bones, it actually has an unexpected application to those words of Chief Noah Seattle Sealth, whichever language, the native or our anglicized version, same person. And it actually, to me, has an echo of that story from Genesis, which we heard as well. You know those opening chapters of Genesis, the creation and origin stories for Jewish and Christian tradition, are likely quite familiar to most of us, if not all of us. If you ever started to read the Bible at the beginning and before you put it down, you probably got through the first few chapters. And you may have recognized, as scholars have long recognized, there are actually two quite differing accounts of creation in the beginning of Genesis. There is chapter 1, and about chapter 2, it switches into a second story. Chapter 1, the story, in the beginning, let there be. It's the story over a succession of days where, out of essentially nothingness, God creates the cosmos and the earth and all that dwells within, including humankind. At the end of each of those days, God's saying, it was good, and then resting on the seventh. We know that creation story in Genesis 1. And the second creation story in Genesis 2 and 3 is a more detailed description of the creation of human beings, the Garden of Eden, the two trees, which we didn't get to in this reading, the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and that interesting and very laden story of eating of the so-called forbidden fruit and the expulsion from the garden. The first story, we get this picture of a cosmic creator who speaks things into being, not things, everything into being. The second story, which is, in fact, far older, the one that we read second came first, and the first came later. You'll get a couple times at that. The second one is a much more intimate portrait of God. This picture of God that is generations, if not centuries, older than the cosmic portrait of God. So they are stories that are so laden with theological tradition and baggage, it can be difficult to see them or hear them anew. So I'm not going to attempt to unpack all of them. But on Earth Day, I want to offer just a few observations on that creation story that we hear today. We have a picture of a very hands-on God. Quite literally, God gets her hands dirty in Genesis 2. God is a gardener. God plants the garden. God doesn't speak this garden into existence, but we're told that God plants the garden. And we have a picture of God as a potter, in effect. Both the human being and later in this chapter, all of the creatures of earth are formed by God like a potter shapes clay from the raw material of the earth. We're reminded even the ancients knew that people and animals were made of the same stuff. But a detail that might escape us is that first human being, whom we call by the name Adam or Adam, is actually a word play in Hebrew. Adam in Hebrew means red or ruddy colored. So not only are the pictures of Adam as white completely wrong, but it refers to the color of earth. It may even have come from any more ancient language, Akkadian, where the word Adam meant to make and to shape. So in that word, both the story of it coming from earth, us coming from earth, and God shaping us from earth are captured in the word Adam, which is gender neutral, by the way, in Hebrew. So instead of it being translated human being, certainly not man, is incorrect. It is more accurately translated, God created this earth creature, this groundling, or if you will, God created an earthling. But what strikes me anew in reading this second story of creation, which was the first story of creation, is the contrast between those stories and what we believe our role is in relation to the earth. Not only in this story are we reminded that we are the very same substance of the earth and all of her creatures, but unlike that first story where the job given to humans is to rule over and then to increase and multiply in creation, this story doesn't have that. This creation story says our human job is this, to till and keep the garden. The earliest first story of creation said we had one job and one job only, till and keep this garden. In this story, if you noticed at the beginning of this story, there is nothing other than God and primordial dirt. There are no plants. There has been no rain. There are no animals. God, dirt, and God creates the first human being before anything else, because in order for creation to grow and flourish, we needed to be present. And that human being was placed in the garden and given that job. Keep it and care for it. So, how have we done with that one job? You know, to care for something means to pay attention to it. Can't care for something that you are not paying attention to. And as I have often said, the first and foremost spiritual practice of all is the practice of paying attention. So our first job was to pay attention in order to care for this garden in which we are placed. The ecofeminist theologian Sally McFaig asked several questions. And her question is simply, how shall we love nature? And the answer is, pay attention, because you cannot love what you do not know. You cannot love what you have not met. You cannot love what you are not paying attention to. Look closely, but in a particular way. Don't look with what she calls this arrogant eye, which this is here for me to use and to exploit. Look with an appreciative, loving eye, because this plant, this creature exists, was created and molded by God for its own existence, not to serve us. That hawk soaring overhead may not have any interest in my life. We humans contrary to our personalities and much theological teaching, are not the center of creation. We are not at the middle of all nature. We are not even at the center of the web. So if we know this, if we pay attention, if we love and dare to care, how then shall we live? Which really is the application question. We can affirm that we are not separate from nature. We understand that the nature does not exist for our use and exploitation, and nature does not revolve around us. But we do have to realize that human beings have a disproportionately far greater impact upon the earth, the magnitude of which the earth is now groaning under. And the greater power that we wield, the greater our responsibility. How then shall we live? We learn to manage ourselves instead of managing nature. It may seem strange, unfamiliar, to make much of Earth Day in church. Many Christian traditions have broken relationships with the earth and creation. But it's not about political correctness. It is deeper than ethics and morality. In our religious community, in our tradition, this is a religious issue. It is a faith issue. It's an issue of faithfulness or our lack thereof to be what God created us to be and to do what God created us to do. Our fulfillment or our lack of fulfillment. We were given one job, to care for the garden. But we cannot care for that which we do not pay attention to. So I want you to take a walk with me in your imagination. It is a very real place, where no one in this room other than me has ever been. But I want you to take a walk with me in your imagination to the place where I first learned to love and care. Any of you who have been here for any length of time know that I was raised in rural western Pennsylvania, north of Pittsburgh, which is the upper end of Appalachia. Full of steel mines, steel mills, coal mines, hunting, football, chewing tobacco, you get the picture. Yes, yes. And the beautiful, mature, rounded off mountains of Appalachia. When I grew up, I knew I was different than most of my cohort, surprise, surprise. Football, hunting, chewing tobacco, I don't know which gave me greater loathing, but but I was lucky. I feel fortunate. There were three places in my life that were safe. My family was safe. Even though I wasn't out when I came out, my family was safe, but my home and my family were safe and loving. My church was safe and loving. And the third place was the woods behind our family home. Behind our house, which was built the summer before I was born, there was a small forest behind it. Probably not more than 2 square acres, so it was really rather small. And over the years, I came to know it extremely well. When I was a small child, my mother had taught me most of the names of the plants and trees that I grew up with. And this forest behind the house was filled with deciduous trees. There were very few evergreens in that area, so mostly deciduous trees. In our area, in that woods, it was maples, elms, black cherry, shagbark, hickory, sassafras. And in the spring, when the leaves of the forest leafed, there is a color of green that is impossible to replicate other than through light filtered through the new green of deciduous tree leaves, was dappled with sun and shade and vibrant and radiant with this amazing green. Now in summer, the trees would be fully leafed and the woods was far more shaded, almost dark, but the undergrowth by summer had become so thick it was almost impenetrable to walk through, except on the few paths that we would occasionally clear or I would trudge down the weeds. And in the summer, the woods would hum with cicadas in the moist mid-Atlantic Appalachian heat. And in autumn, it would blaze with the colors of all of those deciduous trees turning. And it was asleep in winter, gray and black lines against sky. And we ice skated. I learned to ice skate on the small pool that was in the woods, the pond. And over years, probably centuries even, there was a small stream that had carved a ravine of sorts through the woods. And I would explore that little wooded valley almost every day after school. During spring, always during summer and fall. Now, there were very few large animals in the woods. We would see evidence of deer, but we would never see them. There were lots of birds, squirrels. There were the tree-dwelling and the ground-digging kind of squirrels, a rare fox. But I knew and loved the plants best of all. And they were always the most numerous residents you could always find because they didn't scurry away when you came towards them. And I knew them in season, at least. At the edge of the wood, there were blackberries, elderberries, and a few wild strawberries. There were always these pale pink wild geraniums and wild phlox. There was wild anise, the wild licorice that you could snap off a twig and chew on. It was delicious. There were wild grapes, which were lovely to look at, but do not eat them. And in late spring, these unique things called May apples. Does anyone know what a May apple is? Only people from the East know what it is. They grow up literally like these little green umbrellas, about yay tall. They are male and female plants. The male plant is one stalk with a green umbrella. The female May apple is one stalk that divides into two umbrellas and bears a fruit, which looks like a little combination lemon slash banana and apparently tastes a bit like strawberry. That's the texture of a grape on the inside. Extraordinary, extraordinary May apples. Poison ivy was everywhere in abundance, and so was its treatment, which was jewelweed. The sap of jewelweed would alleviate the itching of poison ivy. Ferns grew in lush banks along the stream. Where the stream was its lowest and slowest, it kind of got marshy and sticky with mud, and that's where the skunk cabbage lived. Oh, noxious when crushed. Those odd little hooded flowers. But it grew into this luxurious chartreuse expanse of huge leaves, a chartreuse field of leaves. And I knew all of these residents very well, the common residents. And over years, I discovered there were shire residents hiding as well, Indian paints with fiery red blossoms, maidenhair ferns, trilliums and Jack in the Pulpit, which were not common where I grew up. They're more common here, but they were uncommon where I grew up. Rarely seen. Lots of purple violets, but I discovered white violets, even yellow violets, to my surprise. In the world of my childhood, most places did not seem friendly or welcoming. I didn't quite understand how I would ever fit into the world as I knew it, as a child or an adolescent. But I knew that I was welcome and I fit in, and I was safe in the woods of my childhood. It was sanctuary. That wood holds a romantic and a mystic meaning for me. When my mother moved to Southern California and sold our home, I said goodbye to that wood, and I may never have the opportunity in body to walk that woods in that way again, but it is forever the landscape of my soul. We cannot love, we cannot care for that which we do not know. We were created for and placed in a garden. How can we tend that garden? How can we love the earth? You know, you don't fall in love with generalities. You don't fall in love with people. You start by falling in love with a person. And I don't believe we fall in love with the earth. I believe we fall in love with a patch of the earth. And then it awakens our love and our care and our compassion for ever widening circles. So on this Earth Day Sunday, we remember for what we were made and to what we were first called, our oneness with the earth and our sacred calling to till it, keep it, and care for it. Kelly Mack? You see several clusters of plants, and they are for the taking when you leave today. So you can make a new friend on your way out of church. There are not only the plants for the lilies that we had on Easter Sunday, now past their blossoming, but beautiful green leaves. There are flowering plants. They're in their individual containers. Petunias, snapdragons, oh goodness, salvia. There are ornamental foliage plants. You will see coleas. There are, oh goodness, I can't even tell from up here. And tucked in around them are some edibles as well. There are various lettuces, some parsley, some young celeries. So before you leave today, perhaps when you come up to communion, or before you depart to have lunch and then come back, of course, I invite you to take one of the plants as a reminder, as, in fact, a reaffirmation of your original calling to keep and tend the garden. And for those of you who prefer surprises, there are three dishes of seeds. There are two edible plant seeds and two flowering plant seeds. So if you're just one of those folks who likes to be surprised, you can take one or two of the seeds, plant it, and see what happens. So. We have been created for this. Let us remember that the ground out of which we are made and the ground on which we stand, the ground which we tend, is holy ground. This is holy ground. We're
standing on a holy ground.